disappeared now. You can practice the art of disappearing on the last day. When you go past the donation box, nor your spare cash will disappear. Naughty monk. Okay, all ready to go? 8 o'clock? Good. So, the art of disappearing. This is part of the meditation practice, which I promised I would talk about, and it's a beautiful part. Scary sometimes, but it allows you to see amazing things which happen in your mind and in your body. And sometimes we have this almost illusion of like permanence because we rely on so much. We always think that it's going to be a breakfast at 6:45. Sometimes there's not. We always think there's a lunch at 11 o'clock. Are you sure? Sometimes things which are regular, which you believe you can rely upon, sometimes don't happen. I don't want to scare you about the lunch. I'm sure that's going to happen. I hope, please. But when something is regular and always there, reliable, and then suddenly it's not there anymore. You know what that's called in Pali? Anicca. That is the core meaning of that word. Anicca. It's not things rise and fall. It's something there, and now it's gone. And that is weird. The reason why that I know that as the core meaning of the word anicca is that there was in our Vinaya, our rules of discipline, that the Buddha describes so many things about monastic life. And one of those things is, you know, often there is some group of people come to the temple every Tuesday or every today's Friday. And sometimes I can know what day of the week it is by who's bringing food that day. Because it's a regular commitment to come and say to Dhammasara once a week or once a month or something. And we call that a regular supply of food. It's the opposite of anicca, nicca. It's nicca food. You can almost rely upon it. They say they're going to come every Saturday, every Sunday. So when that stops, that's called anicca. And that's a much more interesting and deeper meaning of that word than what we normally expect from anicca, just rise and fall, comes and go. Now, anicca comes and go, that's a pretty ordinary, easy wisdom. But when it's sort of something's always there and then suddenly it's not anymore, that is weird. And so this is actually what we do to try and get some understanding of wisdom about, you know, our world, our life. And especially that I will begin with that story of when, now I was a young monk, not a young monk yet, a young Buddhist. It was so hard to find places where you could meditate or, you know, where you could listen to any Dhamma talks. So frankly, I didn't mind where I went to meditate because I was open to all Buddhist traditions. It gave me an opportunity to see the various traditions and to see many different types of monks. And of course, Tibetan monks were very popular, Zen monks were very popular. And sometimes you used to like the Zen monks because they were unconventional. Unconventional. And one of the first Zen monks I saw his first lecture when he came to UK and his last lecture before he went back to Japan. And somebody asked him at the last lecture, he said, "You've been in UK traveling around for the last month. What do you think of Buddhism in UK? You know, in England, Scotland, Wales, Ireland. What do you think of Buddhism in this country?" Now, for most of his trip, he had to have a translator with him. But over those months, he actually learned a few words of English. And his response to the question, what does he think is the state of Buddhism in UK, was this. His response, was books, books, books. Too many, too many, too many. Dustbin, dustbin, dustbin. And I must admit, having known Buddhism in that country at that time, that was a pretty articulate description of what was happening in that country. A lot of theory, a lot of discussion on the books, but not real much practice at the time. And that was really true. I think he was also the one who told me later on that he said it was an old Japanese saying. I'd never traced this, whether this is true or not. And a Japanese saying was, whoever writes a book on Buddhism will have to spend the next seven lifetimes as a donkey. And how many books have I written on Buddhism? Oh, my goodness. So in your next life, please be kind to donkeys. One of them might be Ajahn Brah. And you can see what he was saying there. It was too intellectual, too superficial, not really getting into it. But nevertheless, the reason I tell that story was when I was studying, I found one place they were holding a retreat, only a weekend retreat, not that much. So I thought, yeah, I'll sign up for this and go along. And it was a Zen retreat. I don't know if you've ever seen the Zen retreats. But in the Zen retreats, the teacher comes behind you with this big Zen stick. You're facing the opposite direction. He walks very slowly behind you. And if he stops, you're in big trouble. If you're sleepy, nodding a bit slightly, he'll tap you on the shoulder and then whack. Oh, that was really scary. It's true, that's what they used to do. And anyway, it worked for me. Not that I got smacked, but the man meditating next to me got hit. And as soon as he got hit, I was dead straight for the whole retreat. I wasn't going to nod at all. So those of you who have sloth and torpor in your meditation, there's one way of solving it. Well, the problem with that is that later on, because as a monk, especially as a teacher, you get around, and I was visiting one of the monasteries in Hong Kong some years ago, and there's a wonderful monastery. They used to have people come from all different types of Buddhism to stay there and to teach. And I remember the first time I taught there, the end of the retreat which I taught, just before I was about to go to the airport to fly back to Perth, this old Mahayana nun came up to me. She said, I really need to say thank you personally for what you've done here. And I thought, why? You know, teaching deep meditation or giving nice teachings on Eightfold Path, or why? She said, no. The reason I come to thank you is because during this whole retreat, you were smiling and laughing. Before you came, if ever I tried to smile or laugh, I was told off. You're not supposed to laugh or smile as a Buddhist nun in Hong Kong, Mahayana. Now I can smile and laugh as much as I like. Thank you so much, Ajahn Brah, she said. I remember her telling me that, and I was a bit surprised, disappointed that people's expressions of joy and happiness in the path were not acknowledged, and that she had to suppress those. But very happy that you can help change the way that people related to one another. And now she could smile and laugh in public. You know, little things like that, people say that to me, and that actually means a lot to me, that they can, instead of suppressing and suffering. But anyway, back to this Zen monastery in England, that not only did they, you know, hit you if you nodded, but they told us their meditation technique, which I really couldn't understand. You were sitting down in this, it was an old shed in a farm which had been converted. There's a path in between, like to access your seats, and a very small seats like this, but facing the wall. So you had to sit there and just look at the wall, eyes open. I never could understand why people did that, but the thing was, because I was young, I was always willing to try anything and just to test out to see what they were doing and see if it worked. And number two is I'd already done quite a bit of meditation, so I knew how just to sit there quietly in the moment without thinking. So there I was, just sitting there watching this wall, my eyes open, not really knowing what to do. And sometimes when you have no expectations, you don't really know what you're doing. That is a great advantage. My problem here is I've taught you too much. Sorry. But no, it's sometimes helpful. But for here, I didn't know what I was supposed to do. So I was just sitting there quietly, just in the moment, silent, just watching this whitewashed wall. I don't know how many hours I did that for, but then, suddenly, and I say this because it's Friday, payday, the paycheck came. The wall vanished. That was so cool. Because if you're just watching a wall for an hour or two, it gets pretty boring. When something happens, oh yeah, the wall vanished. It wasn't there anymore, which was weird. In all the years I've looked at walls, never once before had I seen one vanish. It just wasn't there anymore. Wow. Imagine you were looking at the wall over there and it vanished. Then the roof would collapse. But this wasn't like that. It was just one minute it was there, next minute it wasn't there. It had disappeared. And, of course, I wasn't scared. I was surprised. And of course, my scientific training said, why? What's happening? And the answer to what was happening opened up this wonderful area of understanding on the art of disappearing and how meditation actually works. Because for many people, it happens all the time. Things disappearing in your field of vision every time you close your eyes. I see the inside of my eyelids, only for a few seconds. Then it turns off, and my sense of sight has been shut down. And that's actually what was happening there with my eyes open. It was boring, nothing happening, not interesting. I wasn't thinking, just looking at a whitewashed wall. And it's just the nature of the brain, and the mind too. It's only wired, it's only set up to notice things which change. Things which are always there, which don't change, they disappear. Just like the sound, the frequency of the air in this room. It hums. But it hums all the time, all the same, all the time. So after a while, you just don't hear it. For example, you may be at home and you've got traffic. It's not like China Grove, which is nice and peaceful, hardly any traffic at all. There's traffic. But as long as the traffic, you know, keeps an even level of sound, after a while you don't notice it anymore. Over here sometimes in the year we have the aircon on. And it makes quite a noise because the big room over here, there's a very big aircon just out there. You know, I can't miss telling this story, that one year the aircon didn't work. It broke. And I think we needed it, we were doing the range retreat, we needed it for warmth. And then we had to have a very cold couple of weeks retreat. And then we got the technicians in afterwards to have a look. You know what happened to it? There was a little cockroach. Oh. It went into the electrical system and it fried itself. At least it died warm. Come on, you've got to see the bright side of things. We live in a forest, that happens. And it cost a lot of money to fix up. But Dimmy was the manager in town. He said, oh, we can claim this on insurance. And Dimmy got away with it. She claimed it on insurance, it was natural damage, and they came and looked at it. They had the corpse of the cockroach there, all fried. And they said, well, it's true. So were the first people in that insurance company's history who got a big payout because of damage by a cockroach. The world is a fascinating place. So we all thanked the cockroach afterwards and gave it a proper sort of send-off. But anyway, it makes a sort of a sound, a natural sound here, but after a while you don't hear it anymore. Because your mind, your brain, is only set up to notice things which change. If there's a constant sound, a constant light, just looking at the whitewashed wall, after a short time, it vanishes. And that is so cool, to see things vanish. You see them with your eyes closed, and after a while, you can't see anymore. It's gone. One less sense you have to bother about. I often say sound is you can be sitting here and not hear anything at all until someone goes bang and the door smashes. Not smashes, but you know, makes a loud noise. Or someone coughs. Or they rustle plastic bags or something. That's why you say, please don't bring any plastic bags into here. You know, you don't need anything in here. As long as the noise is constant, it's not a problem anymore. Which means you can meditate at home as long as the ambient sound is constant or doesn't change that much. Because what happens? Sight turns off. Smell. You know, in the old days, you used to always have lots of incense in monasteries and temples. You know why that was? Because, you know, people's hygiene wasn't that good and their smells would change very much when they did some natural functions. So even here, I've told this many, many times, if you do have sort of digestive problems and you let off a lot of wind, out of compassion for everybody, if you know, do lots of fart, please don't sit in the front. Sit in the back. Because then you're not affecting so many people. Now you know why all those people sitting in the back. Maybe, I'm not sure. But when the smell is constant, it disappears after a while. You may be in a fragrant garden, you may have beautiful flowers or whatever, but after a while you can't smell. It just turns off. And that's also why designing this place, meditation place over here, the kitchen over there, with distance between, so all those smells of food which have to come up about 10:30 or whatever, if the kitchen was right next to this meditation hall, you'd be sitting here and a smell would come up. Oh, yeah. What's that? It'd disturb you because the smell would change. But when the smell is constant, we don't need sort of incense here simply because people's hygiene is much better these days. So you don't need incense. Actually, one of the great things about being a monk who was a scientist before, you always want to investigate and find out why all these Buddhist ceremonies happen. And one of these ceremonies, which I was, for many years, really surprised me. I couldn't find out why people did this, because I was brought up mostly in Thailand as a monk. And I saw when people offered incense to the Buddha statue, we don't have one over here, they put it in the little incense container. They'd only do three incense, and they put it in their hands, and they just put it in. When I went to Singapore, Malaysia, which is a lot of Chinese tradition, they take the incense and they shake it first of all before they put it in. Have you seen that? I always wonder why. Why don't you just put it in instead of shaking it like this? It took me many years to try and find out what the reason for doing that is. And no one could explain it to me, but I finally figured it out myself with some logic. Because you know what happens if you come from a traditional Buddhist family, it is usually your grandma take you to the temple for the first time when you're little kids. So your grandma takes you to the temple and she shows you how things are done. You know, sit like this, do like this. And because grandma's got Parkinson's, when she puts it in the incense container, you do the same. Maybe you're a kid, you haven't got Parkinson's, but you just follow your grandma. That's my theory, anyway. Yeah, there you go, it's because grandma had Parkinson's. I feel like that's how you're supposed to do it. But anyway, so the smell is constant, so smell sort of disappears very quickly. It sort of turns off, like sight turns off. And taste, as long as you don't try and chew something while you're meditating or eat something, you fill yourself up, first of all, so you don't have any taste to worry about. And then you got the physical feeling. That is one of the hardest to turn off. You know, because there's so much going on. You know, there's usually sight, sound, and physical feeling. Sight is easy to turn off. With sound, it'd be wonderful if we had ear lids. So I can actually close the ear lids and couldn't hear anything. And when I want to hear something, I can open them up again. That'd be such a wonderful invention if we can have ear lids. However, we don't have those. And so how can you turn the sense of sound off? Live in a, be in a reasonably quiet place. It doesn't have to be totally quiet. Until the time comes, the brain thinks there's nothing to really to watch. There's no need to be alert. You have to feel safe as well, because this is our most important alarm system, sound. Even you can walk in a forest at night time and it's dark, you listen to what's happening. So you have to feel safe, and you have to not have too much sound going on. And after a while, this sound turns off, you don't hear it. And the physical sense of touch is the hardest to turn off. Because once you are aware of your body, there's sometimes always aches and pains or itches or something. Sometimes those itches and aches are just interesting, full of great insight. So I remember telling, giving a story once in our Nolamara Center. I said, because this is actually a very fortunate time we're meditating here, a little bit earlier than usual. Usually this retreat is in November, next month. But it's a little bit early, which means we just got in before the fly season. There's a couple of flies around, but I think next week, the week afterwards, they'll really come out here, a lot of them. But I was telling people, if there's lots of flies, they're quite safe. They don't come diseases. They're just irritating. And I remember just there was a few flies around our temple in Perth when I was going to teach some meditation one Saturday afternoon. And I said, well, look at these flies. It won't do you any harm. Just let them just crawl around wherever they want to. They go up your nose and down the other side and just exploring, that's all. Just leave it alone. It soon disappears. And that's what I said. But you know what happens when I say such things? And you got the camera on you because all things are recorded. I can't get away with anything. So as soon as I close my eyes and start the meditation retreat, boom, this fly landed on my, just underneath my nose, right here. Now, of course, there's no camera on me. If it's by myself, I just push it away. Or even the other trick. But it's being recorded, one of these recorded talks, like just that here, the camera's on you. You don't have a chance to edit it afterwards. So I thought, oh my goodness, what should I do? And so I have to follow my own teachings and be honest and be, okay, so I let the fly just stay here. It's very good because it meant your mind didn't wander off anywhere. You didn't sort of start falling asleep or thinking about all sorts of unmonkish things. You're thinking about this fly. And then the fly started to move. It didn't fly off. It started to go around my mouth. And it was very interesting because, you know, I'm going to have to let it do what it wants, but I discovered a couple of very important things. That this part of your mouth here on the other side is much more sensitive than on the top on the bottom. So once it got past these parts, it was okay. But as it was coming back again to this part, oh, here it comes again. Oh, and that was very, very, very sensitive. It was so irritating when it went past this. And the next thing I noticed, only, you know, that it was actually a Buddhist fly. That's why it came to our temple in town. The reason I knew it was a Buddhist fly is because it went around three times. In Buddhism, we call it circumambulation. You know, it was going around the thing three times. And as soon as it finished its third circuit, then it flew off. See, it was Buddhist. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. That's true. It actually did that. But, you know, you can't just decide I'm going to ignore it. Because the sense of touch is just so... Ugh. So anyway, but what I did do later on as a monk when I was in Thailand, I was one of the first monks to set up this Wat Pa Nanachart in Thailand. And for those of you who don't know, it wasn't called Wat Pa Nanachart first, it was called Wat Pa. Wat Pa means forest monastery, America. What? Because most of the monks there were, you know, ex-GIs from the Vietnam War or something. And I was the only English one there. And so that's why it was called Wat Pa America Wat until some more foreigners from other countries came. So anyway, when it was opened up, there was no huts, there was no hall, there was no toilets. It was out in the forest. And it was a dangerous forest too. Not just snakes, but ghosts. It was a local cremation ground. So they'd bring the bodies there and they'd burn them. And we'd stay there overnight and overnight. Who knows what was creeping through the forest? But I wasn't afraid of ghosts. And people said, aren't you afraid staying in the cremation ground overnight with all those ghosts there? I said, no. I said, why? I said, well, look, I can't understand Thai. I don't know what the ghosts are saying. How can they scare you when you don't know what the heck they're on about? Said the ghost. If the ghost could speak English, then it'd be a bit more scary. But anyway, you weren't so afraid of the ghosts, but what you were really afraid of, because it was real, was the mosquitoes. This was in the jungle, and this was mosquitoes' home. And Ajahn Chah, I don't know why he did this, he decided to come over every evening, about 6 p.m., to do a two-hour meditation and a talk. So we all had to join in. 6 p.m. That was mosquito dinner time. They'd all come out looking for something to eat. And this was the first time in many parts of the northeast of Thailand, the first time they had Westerners, Western monks. Well, I still remember this, that when I was in that part of the world, sometimes I would go to a village, and I was actually the first white man they had ever seen in the whole village. They didn't have TVs. And I was a monk. And when I was on alms round, the rule was in Thailand, when you put food in a monk's bowl, you're supposed to look at the bowl, not look at the monk. But it's the first white monk they'd ever seen. And so when they were putting little balls of sticky rice in my bowl, they're looking up at me, and most of the rice was missing. Fell outside the bowl. But it's not so much the villagers I was concerned about, the mosquitoes. This was the very, very, very first time they had Western food. A delicacy. And Ajahn Chah would not allow any mosquito repellent any mosquito nets, anything to try and keep the mosquitoes away. And sometimes we beg him, please, can we have some repellent or something? And he said, no. He said, you can call those mosquitoes Ajahn Mosquito. That's where we got that phrase from. They're going to be your teachers. It's not a very nice thing to say when they're driving you mad, but nevertheless, it was true. So when you were sitting down there in the jungle, 6 to 8, being devoured by mosquitoes, the first thing I did was a stupid, like, boy thing, that with the other monk sitting next to me, we did a little competition, who could count the most mosquitoes on your arm. And this is no joke, about 60 to 80, a one go on your arm. And you couldn't count them anymore because they were too close together. You couldn't notice the difference. All you could hear was a slurp of blood. Now that's an exaggeration. But the number of mosquitoes was an exaggeration. It was just really torture. And every now and again, you'd open your eyes and look at Ajahn Chah, and he was just sitting there so peacefully. If he wasn't there, he'd have run away. So it didn't help by counting. But something else did help. I realized when you sat down there, you had a couple of hours, and if you didn't get into a decent meditation quickly, if you didn't go beyond your body in the first 10 or 15 minutes, you'd suffer. So, sitting there, make yourself nice and comfortable. And you know what, the mosquitoes, I don't know why they do this, they must be sadistic. Because they don't just bite you, they go, bzz, 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 bzz. They let you know what's coming. Bzz, 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 bzz. I'm going to bite you. But anyway, sitting there, okay, you can just tell me what you're going to do. But I'm going to meditate. So, you know, just relax your body pretty quickly. You know, it's fit, you know, reasonably healthy. So, you know, it's very easy to sort of sit down and make your body nice and peaceful. And then just go inside, you know, to your present moment awareness and silence. And then go on to your breath. And once you're really focused on your breath, you can feel your body. So at that point, the mosquitoes could do whatever they wanted, because you couldn't feel your arms or your head or anything else which was exposed. You were just nicely happy inside. Once I started doing that, it was amazing. You could meditate nice and peacefully for a couple of hours. But the weird part was, and I thought it was weird at first, I thought it was like, you know, like a psychic power, because when you came out of meditation, you looked to your arms and you had no mosquito bites on the arm. No, for a Westerner, when you get bitten by a mosquito, a little bump comes up. And it's quite an itchy bump. But I looked at my arm, there's hardly anything there at all. I thought, the power of meditation. Giving you this field of protection around you. So the mosquito's trying to buzz and trying to get through your protective shield, and they can't do it. And I thought, wow, well, that was my theory anyway. And it wasn't until you come to a place like Australia and people know you as a scientist or was before. You know, I'm still a member of the Australian Institute of Physics. They keep on sending me all these invitations to come to their events. It's really weird. And was it CSRIO? They always send me the latest news as well. I'm well connected. But not to mosquitoes, thank goodness. Because when you meditate like that, there was no bumps, they weren't biting you. It was only when I looked at an article, they said most mosquitoes are attracted to the carbon dioxide coming out from your pores. The higher your metabolism, the more you're waving the flag to the mosquitoes, hey, come over here, eat me. Because that's what they know, there's a human being there, and the carbon dioxide coming out. The more you relax, the more you don't worry, the more you meditate nice and deeply, so you're hardly breathing at all, and not much carbon dioxide is going out because you're really still, then the mosquitoes can't find you. You vanish. Ha ha ha, mosquitoes, you've been outwitted. And that means you can meditate somewhere with lots of mosquitoes, they just can't find you. And I thought that's so cool. But it was the mosquitoes who taught me how to meditate, you know, properly without just wandering off under thought. Just relax and get very peaceful. So my body disappeared. You couldn't feel it. Oh, what bliss. And of course, you know, that's the first time I really learnt that technique, because the mosquitoes taught me. It was that or suffer. And I don't like suffering. And sometimes people think, Ajahn Brahm, you know, you're a monk, you know, why don't you just relax and take it easy? So I am relaxing and taking it easy. You guys are torturing yourself. And I'm trying to share it with you to, you know, learn how to relax. So your body vanishes. But, you know, you still got your breath. Because it's very hard, difficult, for your body to disappear all in one go. That's why, you know, trying to find similes, the simile of like the breath being like a stepping stone. You're crossing a river, and it's too wide to just jump over. But fortunately, there's a stepping stone in the middle, so you can go onto that stepping stone. From the stepping stone, you can go onto the other side. And that's like the breath. It's part of the body feeling, but it's like inside most of the body. So when you're watching the breath go in and go out, you can't feel the rest of the body if you really get into it. And then after a while, from the breath, that can disappear, and you go into the mind. Nimittas and jhanas. That's the mind world, the sixth sense. So anyway, one other way of doing that and focusing, you've got the breath, and sometimes you've got the breath. So now just, you know, you got to that stage, you're watching the breath, and sometimes you can feel an ache on the arm or something, or there's a fly just lands on you, and you can sort of feel it, but you know, you're not totally disturbed yet. Or you hear a sound in the distance and tries to get your awareness of sound coming back again when you already shut it off. What do you do? And Ajahn Chah used to get so much of his wisdom from being in the forest, being in the jungles. That's why I said that simile of the mango orchard planted by the Buddha. Sit perfectly still, hold your hand out, you get a mango straight away. Because, you know, that was his life in the forest, in the jungles. But for me, I was spending most of my time not in jungles, but in aircraft. Flying around, teaching. And to the point that it happened once, I was doing so much traveling around in aircraft, somebody, they were doing some interview for me, and I was actually just preparing the opening address to some conference or series of talks. They want to have a quick bio of me, you know, who I was, and said, where do you live, Ajahn Brahm? And I said, in aircraft. And it was actually quite accurate, spending more time in the aircraft than in the monastery. But anyway, so that in the aircraft, because I lived so much in the aircraft, you actually learn so much. One of the things I learned was about focusing. Because even though you didn't watch the movies, you had to watch the in-flight safety video. And you saw this little plastic screen on the back of the seat in front of you. And when you turned it on, or when it turned itself on, you saw that plastic screen and had a plastic rim on the outside, and outside that was the upholstery of the chair. A strange thing happened when you started to watch. As you started to watch, your field of vision narrowed. It was drawn in to the important video announcements. And soon I noticed I couldn't see the upholstery on the screen. I couldn't even see the rim of the TV, whatever you call it. My mind actually shrank and just fitted in almost exactly to the screen in front of me. So I could see the in-screen safety video without being disturbed by what was going on the outside. And then later on, I saw you guys with these small iPhones seeing some little movie or some video which was important to you. I said, how can you see it on such a small screen? And then I went to people's houses and saw these huge screens. Why do you want those huge screens for? Because you actually can see it on your small iPhone. What's the difference? Check it out. It's only when you're not focusing in do you realize how big that screen is or how little it is. I remember some years ago I told that to somebody and they really understood it. They were about to buy this huge, what is it called, plasma screen TVs or LEC, whatever it is, screens. Whatever, you know, the big screens they have in their houses these days, takes up the whole wall. And they're going to pay a lot of money for that. You don't need that. Just get, you know, a new iPhone. You can see it quite clearly, whatever you want to see. And you know what they did? They said, okay, we'll do that. And the difference, the amount of money they saved, they gave to Jhana Grove. Yay! But it's true. But it also shows you how focusing works and how things disappear. You know, you're watching your body to start off with, relaxing it. You can hear other people moving. You can hear me speak. You can hear people cough. But then make sure your body's in the center and all these other things are on the edges. And only after a short while, you'd be quite surprised how easy it is. Your mind just shrinks and focuses just on your own body. You can sort of hear other people, but they're a long way away, even though they're just sitting next to you. That's how it feels. And as you relax your body, it becomes so calm and peaceful, not disturbing at all. You can just watch your peaceometer or inside the mind, present moment awareness. You can sort of feel the body at first, but you're focusing on the peaceometer or on the present moment. When you're focusing on your present moment, all that stuff starts to disappear. I should have not have said the present moment yet, because when you're in the present moment, you can feel a little bit of the past and the future at first. We just focus on the present. What's in the center of all of this? And this is like centering, focusing, allowing yourself to go inside things rather than being drawn away from things. It doesn't take that much of a practice. For all of you who are looking at me right now, you'll focus on my face. You probably can't see the Buddha, which is to my left, no, to your right and your view, because you tend to focus in on things. It's a natural phenomena. When you have your lunch, all you can see is what's on your plate. You focus in on the things which you're really interested in. And so if you're really interested in the present moment, you focus in and the past and the future vanish. They disappear. And they are disappearing. Wow. There are some things which deserve to disappear. Your past. Bye-bye past, your future. Bye-bye future. Just imagine you could do that whenever you wanted. Because you know your past, oh, so many things happened to you. There's so much unfinished business of the past. And I'll tell you one great truth. That will always be unfinished. You'll never be able to change it, to heal it, to do anything with it. You can always say, bye-bye. And have done with it. You can't fix it up. You can say goodbye. And it can disappear. Oh, what a wonderful thing that is. But it's really weird. When you do have your past memories and stuff, why is it that for most people, they let go of half of their past, the good things, the happy things, and they keep focusing on the mistakes and things which went wrong? That's absolutely crazy. If you're going to let go of some of the past, please let go of the rubbish past. Let that go. Bye-bye past. Just like that simile which I give. It's not so relevant now, but this was so clear about 20 years ago. When you go to people's houses and they'd have photographs on the walls, and I see those photographs, it'd be of their marriage, their graduation from college, of going on a lovely holiday somewhere, all these wonderful, happy photographs. And I commented, I've never seen yet a photograph of the two of you going to the lawyer for divorce proceedings. I've never seen you stuck in traffic on the way to work and taking a photograph of that. I've never seen a photograph of you in hospital, really sick. On holiday, yes, but not sick in hospital. Why don't you be fair and take photographs of real life, the whole of life? Stuck at work, doing extra work in the evening because you didn't finish the assignment and your boss is on your back. At home, we keep the happy photographs. Why? Because they uplift us and cause happiness. But in our mind, we keep the unhappy ones. The time you're told off, the time there's a tragedy in your life, the time when something really rotten happened. Why do you keep those photographs? That's why the one part of a computer I love is the delete button. It's wonderful having a delete button. Delete, 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 delete. And you ever notice delete? You know, the middle words are L-E-T. So I wanted to change it. Let go. I call it a let go button, not a delete button. So all those past memories which are bad, you can bye-bye. And keep the good ones, the happy ones. Why not? But even better than that, just throw the whole lot away. So you're totally free. You're unburdened. You don't get these little apps coming up saying that your memory is full. You delete the whole lot. Or even better than that, I just can't believe just how people live. That, you know, yeah, people had a few extra belongings, but they managed to have little cupboards they could store them in. But now the houses are so much bigger than the houses I grew up in. But still, even though I've got these huge houses with sheds in the back, still you've got to go to these storage units where, you know, you pay a few dollars, I don't know how much it costs, and you get all this storage space you can put all your rubbish in. What do you do that for? So all these storage units, because you know, when you travel, you look out the window, see all these new storage units being built. Crazy stuff. If you're not using it, then give it away. Or even just make use of it until it all falls apart. Why do we always want new things? My robes here, they usually last about 3 or 4 years. They don't see me. That's why you don't see any robe shops in Perth. What's the latest fashion robe? I sometimes thought about that. You get a Versace robe. Or a Gucci. Of course, you don't have anything like that. Just a robe, that's all nice and easy. But anyway, so when you can let go of the past by focusing on the present. So the past and the future vanish by themselves. They disappear. And I'm really laboring this point because just when the past and future disappears, it's blissful. You're like free. You know, you're like a young child born. You can see the young children. They can play around. Yeah, somebody upsets them. The next minute, they're happy again and playing together. They don't hold the past like so-called mature people do. I don't know why this happens. Sometimes the people come and say, "Oh, Ajahn Brahm, I should have said that to you. Now I ask forgiveness." And I'm honest with you. I say, "What did you do?" "I can't remember that." "So it was yesterday." "Oh, yeah, yesterday's a long time ago. Come on." Let go. You don't carry things. It makes you lovely and free. See, you have enough stress in your life. So why can't you let go of the past and don't worry about the future? You're letting go of time. What a wonderful thing is you're learning. By letting this moment, letting the present moment be. That's how letting go happens. By maintaining interest and value in the opposite. Present moment awareness. And then with this set of the body, you looked after it enough. And with the breath, it's very much, somebody reminded of this, they said that sometimes when they meditate, it's like parking their car and they're walking away from it. Yeah, that's an old simile, very good simile. So you're sitting down here on your seat, on your cushion, wherever you park your body. Make sure everything's okay. And then leave. Your body will be okay afterwards. Just like dropping your car off at the car park, and then you go back afterwards and it's still there. It's nice and safe. So you don't have to worry so much about your body. And also, you get into delightful breath. And the body vanishes. All you have is the breath. Going in and going out. And when you focus in on that, with focusing on the center, like that video screen in the seat in front of you, after a while, what's on the outside vanishes. Does it by itself. You focus even more into the breath. And it does. You know, it happens. It's delightful to have little to worry about. You feel so free. And then you have the delight comes up, and the delight is almost like in the center of the breath, and then the breath vanishes. It's not there anymore. It disappears by itself. You can't feel it. All we have is delight. When the delight takes over, because the breath has vanished, then you notice that basically the five senses are just about gone. You're not seeing, you're not hearing, not smelling, not tasting, not touching. Oh, that's so nice. That's where the delight is coming from. And it just builds, you have these wonderful nimitters. When you have nimitters, just go into the center of them, whatever that center is, the most beautiful part. Allow yourself to focus in. Just like the visions on the screen in front of you. If this was a mobile phone, you'd look at it and soon your vision would go right into the interesting, beautiful part. And as it goes in and in and in, it gets more on things on the outside, fall off the radar, they disappear. And you notice you can't feel the body, you can't hear any sounds, having a wonderful time deep inside. And go inside the beautiful nimitters which are there, always going to the center of things, the most beautiful part. It becomes almost like a habit, always going inwards, inwards, inwards. That is the real meaning, going inwards, inwards, inwards. That's the real meaning of insight meditation. Seeing in, insight. No one laughed. Because insight meditation is supposed to be a totally different type of meditation. But anyway, that's what I call insight meditation, because it's true to its words, going in. And as it goes in, there's beautiful lights inside the mind. You go deeper into those lights. You don't do anything. You don't decide, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. Just allow it to happen. It's almost like you get sucked in. As you get sucked in, the lights get more beautiful and more stable. Those are the two things which, it's not you do, you just watch watch them happen. In when you're doing nimittas. And it's what the Buddha said, was it the Abhipramojjhayang Cittang and Samadhayang Cittang. Abhipramojjhayang, for want of a better word, I call it brightening up the nimitta, just making it more beautiful, seeing the more beautiful side of the most beautiful side of that nimitta. You just go in and it just gets very beautiful. It gets more delightful as you focus deeper into it. And it also gets more stable until you get this beautiful light. It doesn't move. It's brighter and brighter and brighter. Ooh, this is good stuff. And if that's all you get in this meditation, wow, you're really getting deep. And then you're just that far, that far. Maybe that far. Just eventually just get sucked in and go into the jhana realms. In the jhana realms, even the first jhana, they say it is a bliss born on being separated from your body, totally separated from seeing, hearing, smelling, taste, and touch. You can't feel your body. And simile number one, there's one gentleman I think some of you may remember him. He used to be our treasurer years and years ago, good old Ron Story. And he was in the British Army, and he always had these terrible migraines. And whenever he was on some exercises, he told me this when he was in Germany doing some exercises, that he would be in charge of a group of soldiers, and the order would come on the radio, no, stop, have a cup of tea. British Army, that's what they would always do. And so he said, I don't want a cup of tea, I've got a migraine. There's a farmhouse just around the corner here. I'm just going to go in their barn and sit quietly in the dark. It's the best way he could deal with his migraine. And he said, when he had his migraines, he sat in the dark. He said, he would just, this is actually exactly what he said, he'd go inside, go in, where the migraine wouldn't reach him. He'd have some freedom from his migraine. But little did he know that what he was actually doing was actually going into a jhana. The migraine was forcing him in there, like the mosquitoes were forcing me to just go inside so I couldn't feel the biting on the flesh. But he told me it must have been a jhana, because one day he said, no, not one day, it happened regularly, that the call came in, stop your tea break, get in the truck, we've got to carry on. So all the soldiers got in the truck, started driving off. Uh-oh, we've forgotten our, I think it was a sergeant. So they had to go back, go into the old barn where he was still sitting peacefully, and they picked him up. They picked him up and carried him to the truck and put him in the back. And then a few kilometres down the road, that's when he came out of his quietness. Hey, how did I get here? I was in the barn. Now, soldiers are not the most delicately touched human beings. They're quite rough. So how he never felt being picked up, carried, and dropped in the back of a truck, and hear the noise of the truck, was quite astounding. It was actually quite solid evidence that when you are in those deep meditations, you can't hear a thing. And you can't feel anything. That's really neat when that happens. You see someone sitting here. Touch one shoulder, time for lunch. They don't even feel it. You shout at them, time for lunch! They're just sitting here. They're not dead. And just a quick piece of advice here. If you ever think your wife is dead because she's sitting so quietly and peacefully, just feel the temperature of her skin. If it's still warm, she's not dead yet. She's just in a deep meditation. It's the warmth of the body which tells you whether it's a deep meditation or not. So anyway, just sometimes you've just got to let them come out whenever they want to come out. Whether the momentum, the depth of letting go is exhausted, then they just come out naturally. They're quite safe. But anyway, this is when the body disappears. And they call that the bliss of the first jhana. Vivekaja piti sukha. Vivekaja means like being separated from the five senses and the body. It's such a bliss. Sometimes we always think these five senses are going to give us happiness, but when actually they're subdued, ooh, that's really delicious. Much better than the highest pleasures you can get with any of the senses. And then you get even more still. You go inside of that, still centering in. And just the coarseness of that first jhana, there's still a bit of movement of the mind there. When that vanishes, you go to what you might call perfect stillness. The second, third, fourth jhanas are so still. I mean, really still. I mean, nothing moves. That is because will, choice, the thing which does move your mind, that is gone. It's vanished. And that's what I say, when will vanishes, that's so amazing. You can't touch anything, you can't do anything. It's like, you know, the mouse which you use to click your computer is gone. Who stole it? It's not there anymore. So you can't move. There's nothing you can do. Just aware. And you don't really worry about that, because it's, again, so incredibly beautiful to be free of your will. The will you have, you don't need to exert your will all the time. It's always there just in case. When it's totally gone, you think that's scary. No way. That's beautiful. And there you really realize your own insight, how much of a tormentor is this will. And Then you go even into the deeper jhanas. Things vanish and disappear. And we get to the fourth jhana. That's, I'll just quickly rushing past one. That's when perfectly still, equanimous, and I wouldn't say equanimous anymore, content. So happy just being silent, no will, no body, deep in the mind. And they actually say, well, the Buddha says, this is the peak of mindfulness. You can't get more pure mindfulness than that in a fourth jhana. You just know and doesn't move. And what happens next? Because your mind is still, because the mental consciousness is not moving. What happens when things are still? Things start to disappear. So this is when your mental consciousness starts to disappear, stage by stage, piece by piece, because of stillness. It's in those stages it's so obvious that your mind, your knower, your consciousness is also a problem. It's suffering. It's a pain. Little by little it starts to disappear. And the more it disappears, the more bliss you feel. Profound states of ecstasy as you vanish. Bye bye. Sadhu. 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 Okay, hope you enjoyed that. And for those of you who are a bit challenged by talks like that, you're totally vanishing everything. I always remember the Singaporean. He was a president at the time of the Buddhist Fellowship over there where I used to go to. And he once asked me, he was a top lawyer. He said, can you give a deep Dharma talk tonight? You know, we're intelligent, we're well-learned. Not the sort of the two bad bricks and that sort of stuff. You really get into it. So I did. And this is the sort of talk I gave him. And afterwards, the next morning, he picked me up to take me to breakfast. He said, please don't ever do that again. I didn't sleep all night. I was terrified. And if you are afraid, the Buddha said that. Sometimes even his monk disciples would be afraid when he talked about the nature of reality and that just how you disappear with nothing left. Oh, no, I'm not ready for that. I want something left, please. I worked so hard to get enlightened. Please, please, let me enjoy it. But this is what happens. So anyway, any questions on the piece of paper for tonight? Thank you.